So the first thing, Diana was correct. Rohitasa Sutta, the Buddha says, the world is this body with its perceptions and mind. So it's nama and rupa. So that would not be a sutta you could use to say you can just do mindfulness of the body, because it's actually talking about the mind as well. So why do we die? I don't mean heart disease or cancer or stepping in front of a bus. I mean, why do we have to die? If you were making it up, would you make it up that we die? I mean, think about it. You get born. That's traumatic enough. And then you do the diaper thing. And finally, you start having fun, and they grab you and ship you off to school for, what, 12, 16, 24 years. And then when you get out, whenever that is, they put you to work. You work for 40 years. Finally, you can kick back and relax, and you die. What's going on here? Maybe we're not doing something we should be doing. What if we hung a lot of crystals in the windows? And no, they do that in California and they still die. Maybe we're doing something we shouldn't be doing. Do you realize that over 95% of the people that ever ate food are now dead? So, that's probably not going to work either. One thing's for sure. If you don't get born, you don't die. And if you do get born, sooner or later you wind up dead. Of course, that only raises the question, why bother being born if you're just going to wind up dead? Being born is a really popular thing to do. Like, everybody I know did it. Birds do it, bees do it. But they're all going to wind up dead. Well, it would appear that Mother Nature has this urge to become. And this urge to become winds up leading to birth. And birth eventually is going to lead to death. So what about becoming? Where does becoming come from? Well, we look at this building. It didn't used to be a meditation hall. It used to be wood and glass and metal, probably over here someplace, right? And then they put all the pieces together, and with the pieces clinging together, it became a meditation hall. So the becoming appears to be dependent upon clinging. And the clinging leads to becoming, leads to birth and death. Okay, what about clinging? Well, what do you cling to? Like a pair of worn-out socks with holes in them? Nah, you give that to anybody that comes to your door, right? You cling to the good stuff, the stuff that's desirable. The stuff you really want, the stuff you crave, right? You crave it, and when you get it, then you're going to cling to it. And that clinging leads to becoming, birth, death. All right, so the good stuff is the stuff that you crave. So, like, what do you crave? Chocolate ice cream? You crave chocolate ice cream when you're in the store because it's in a round container, right? No. You crave chocolate ice cream because it's brown. No. You crave chocolate ice cream because it tastes good. It produces pleasant vedana. The craving arises dependent on the vedana. And if it's a pleasant vedana, then you crave to have it. And if it's an unpleasant vedana, you crave to make it go away. And all this craving can lead to clinging, becoming, birth, death. All right, so where did the vedana come from? Well, do you get the vedana when you see it in the round container in the store? No. You get the pleasant vedana when you're paying for it? No. You get the pleasant vedana when you pull it out of the bag? Maybe a little bit, but not enough to pay money for it, right? Hopefully you put away the rest of the groceries before you rip the top off and you grab a spoon and you stick the spoon in. And it's when the spoon goes in, right? That's when you get the pleasant fade. Now you buy it so you can stick the spoon in? I don't think so. It's when the ice cream hits the tongue, contact. That's when the pleasant Vedana shows up. And more, and the craving is set in, and the clinging, and you're not going to tell your roommate about it, and you're going to hide it behind the frozen chicken, right? That's clinging, which leads to becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, and despair. Okay, contact. Why does contact arise? Well, we have these senses. And you leave your senses hanging out in the environment. I mean, you're sitting in here meditating. Somebody makes some noise and you get perturbed. And the reason you get perturbed is you left your ears turned on, right? And so you get a sense contact. You go walking outside and you see things. You try to go walking outside with your eyes closed and you bump into a tree and then you fall down. You got to have your eyes turned on to navigate the environment. It's these senses that generate the sense contacts, and the contacts are inevitably going to generate Vedana. And if you're not careful, the Vedana is going to lead to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, death. All right, what about these senses? Well, that's part of having a mind and body. A mind and body with no senses would be, well, senseless. It wouldn't last very long at all. You need the senses in order to keep the mind and body alive. And having senses, they get contacts, and the contacts are going to lead to Vedana. And if you're not careful, there'll be craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. All right, what about this mind and body? Well, one thing's for certain, it needs to be conscious. If you have a mind and body that's not conscious, and it stays not conscious, it winds up dead. Well, I guess they can force feed you now, but that's no quality of life, right? Mind and body is really dependent upon consciousness. And having a mind and body means there are going to be senses that get sense contacts that are going to generate Vedana that, if you're not careful, is going to generate craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. What about consciousness? Well, consciousness seems to arise due to the interaction of mind and body. Consciousness is dependent on mind and body is dependent on consciousness. It's like two sheaves of wheat leaning against each other. You pull one away and the other one falls over. They are mutually interdependent. So having a conscious mind and body, you will have senses that will get sense contacts that will inevitably produce Vedana. And if you're not careful, that's going to produce craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, despair, and all the rest of the dukkha. This is dependent origination, paticca-samuppada. Perhaps more accurately translated as dependent co-origination, but I don't use that phrase because if I do, I wind up with students talking about codependent origination, and it does not mean codependent origination. All right, so dependent origination or dependent arising. Now, I just outlined to you 10 links of dependent origination in the so-called reverse order, starting with something and saying it arises dependent on something else, and that something else arises dependent on something else again. So that's the reverse order. And there were only 10 links. The 10-link model seems to be an earlier model. You find it in, for example, Samyutta Nikaya 1265. Samyutta Nikaya 12 is the book on dependent origination. There's almost 100 suttas on dependent origination in that book. And number 65 is the Buddha describing the night of awakening. And he doesn't talk about the jhanas, And he doesn't talk about remembering past lives. He doesn't talk about seeing beings passing away or re-arising according to their karma. And he doesn't even talk about the Four Noble Truths. He talks about discovering dependent origination. You can see, you know, he sits down under the tree, and it's like, all right, I'm going to sit here until I figure this out or the flesh rots from my bones. Okay, so why do we die? Well, because we're born. That's a necessary condition for death. So why do we get born? And he works his way back and comes up with these 10 links. But the 10 link model is only one of many of the recensions of dependent origination that you find in the suttas. Sometimes you find 9 links or 7 links, or, well, in the Four Noble Truths, the first Noble Truth says dukkha happens, which basically implies if you're born, you'll experience dukkha. So that's those 2 links. And the second Noble Truth says that dukkha arises dependent on craving. So there's 2 links there, leaving out some of the other ones that are traditionally put in. We don't always find all the links. The most common way that dependent origination is described is with 12 links. There are 2 links that come before mind and body and consciousness. So mind and body is said to be dependent on consciousness, and consciousness is dependent on sankharas. Sankhara is one of the most, if not the most important word to understand in Pali. I mentioned earlier it gets translated a number of different ways. Compounded things, mental activities, mental fabrications, conditioned things, concoctions, which is a good translation, fabrications. People want to make it karmic formations, independent origination. I don't think that's quite what is meant. It just serves a, shall we say, a later purpose. And then sankharas are dependent on ignorance, avijja. And there's a famous depiction of these 12 links of dependent origination that occurs in the Tibetan tradition. And it's the wheel of life. The wheel of life is a circle with a bunch of concentric circles in it, sort of like a target. And this wheel is being held by Yama, the Lord of Death. You can see his fangs up at 12 o'clock and his claws at 10 and 2. And his other claws down there at 5 and 7, and his tail swishing back and forth at 6. And in the center, in the bullseye position, usually what's depicted is a rooster, a snake, and a pig, each biting the tail of the other. The rooster represents greed, the snake, hatred, and the pig, delusion. In the ring around that, we have beings coming out of states of woe to very nice states and then falling back down again into states of woe, the circle of samsara. The next ring, which is the biggest ring, is where the artist has the most fun because it depicts the 6 realms of existence. Down at the bottom, we have the hell realms, plural. These are depicted in ways that Dante would be proud of. You know, people being boiled alive or roasted or walking through a forest and all the leaves are swords and, you know, all the good stuff you find in hell, right? Above the hell realms, there's the realm of the hungry ghosts. These are beings that in their previous life were very greedy and now they've been reborn with giant bellies and very tiny throats and they're never satisfied. Also in the lower realms is the realm of the warring gods, the asuras. These gods are always fighting. It appears that their current headquarters is in a 5-sided building just south of Washington, D.C. Also in the lower realms is the animal realm. And here the artist has fun painting bunny rabbits and deer and, you know, all the cute little animals. Above the animal realm is the human realm. And the artist paints people doing human things, working in the fields, making handicrafts, eating, sleeping, making love, you know, all the usual stuff. And then up at the top are the God realms, the heavenly realms. Again, plural. And it's the usual thing, you know, sitting on a cloud, playing a lute rather than a harp, but, you know, eating ambrosia, you know, the stuff you do every time you get to go to heaven. But the outer ring is the most important ring because that depicts the 12 links of dependent origination. Up at the top, we have ignorance, avidya. Ignorance is depicted as an old blind person trying to make their way through a forest. Arising dependent on ignorance, we have sankharas. Sankhara is depicted as a potter sitting at a wheel making pots. Some of the pots are very nice, and some are misshapen, and some are broken. So nice constructions, nice fabrications, and not so good fabrications. Arising dependent on fabrications, on sankharas, is consciousness. Consciousness is depicted as a monkey swinging through the trees, grabbing first one branch and then another. Perhaps at some recent point in time, you've become familiar with this monkey mind. Okay, so the way that this is sometimes interpreted is that in your previous life, you were ignorant. And out of ignorance, you acted in certain ways that generated karmic formations that have now given rise in this life to the consciousness that you have. This is part of the multiple lifetime interpretation of dependent origination. So your consciousness in this life is due to the actions you undertook in your ignorant previous life. I think there's a better interpretation, which is that consciousness arises dependent upon an object. We don't find objectless consciousness in Buddhism. Just the concept makes no sense. You're conscious of something, and the something you're conscious of is a sankhara. And the sankhara is something that you have carved out of the holistic sensory input that you're getting. You've taken the whole of the universe and you've chopped it up into, yeah, my glasses, or my timer, or the bell, or whatever. So out of ignorance, you chop the world up into individual bits and pieces because it's just so much easier for your little pea brain to deal with the bits and pieces than to deal with the whole of the universe. And that's what you become conscious of. Dependent on consciousness is mind and body. As we said, you need a mind and body that's conscious if it's going to actually function properly. Mind and body is depicted as two people in a boat. One is standing up and pulling the boat along. The other is laying flat, just along for the ride. So one of these is mind, one of these is body. Clearly, the guy standing up pulling the boat along is the one who's determining where the boat goes. So, one of the first insights that you are to gain on the path is who is in charge, your mind or your body? Again, you can bring the answer to me as a homework assignment. But what I suggest is you get concentrated and then you investigate your mind and investigate your body. And notice that each of them has their own realm, their own things that they do. They definitely interact. But you might notice that your body breathes, your mind's not breathing, and your mind knows that your body is breathing. The body doesn't know, it just breathes. And you can investigate this, and hopefully you figure out who's in charge, the mind or the body. Arising dependent on mind and body are the senses. We don't find senses wandering around by themselves. They need to be embedded in a mind, in a body, and for them to work, there has to be a working mind. The senses are depicted as a house having five windows and a door. The five windows representing the five external senses, and the door representing the mind. Arising dependent on the senses is contact, and contact is depicted as a couple embracing. Arising dependent on contact are Vedana. Vedana is depicted as a man having arrows shot into his eyes. Unpleasant Vedana. Arising dependent on Vedana is craving. Craving is depicted as a very fat person sitting at a table that's heavily laden with food. Arising dependent on craving is clinging. Clinging is depicted as someone picking fruit and putting it into baskets that are so full that the new fruit simply rolls out onto the ground. Arising dependent on clinging is becoming. Becoming is depicted as a pregnant woman. Arising dependent on becoming is birth. And birth is depicted as a woman with a newborn, and arising dependent on birth is death. And death is depicted as a corpse. So these are the 12 links, and this is the most common way that dependent origination is described in the suttas. So what does it mean? Well, it's not really obvious right off the bat. In fact, Carolyn Rhys Davis, one of the early translators, referred to dependent origination as a curious old room. And there have been lots and lots of discussions and so forth trying to say what this means. The orthodox view is found in the Visuddhimagga, and that's the three lifetimes model of dependent origination. The first two links of ignorance and sankharas represent your previous life. So in your previous life, you were ignorant, and out of your ignorance, you acted in certain ways, karmic formations, is how they're interpreting sankhara. And that karma produced the consciousness that you have in this life, and a mind and body that's dependent on that consciousness, that has the senses that get the contacts that produce the Vedana, and if you're not careful, there's the craving and clinging. And so that's your current life. And your future life is becoming birth and death. And as I say, this is the orthodox interpretation. There's a couple of problems with the orthodox interpretation, one of which is that it has a very serious logical flaw. You see, in many, many suttas, we find the Buddha saying, with the ceasing of ignorance, there's the ceasing of sankharas. With the ceasing of sankharas is the ceasing of consciousness. With the ceasing of consciousness, all the way up to, with the ceasing of birth, is the ceasing of old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, despair, and all the rest of the dukkha. Okay? So you want to get rid of the dukkha. Well, all you got to do is uproot the ignorance in your previous life. What? I mean, you probably don't even remember your previous life. And how are you going to go back and change your previous life? I mean, uprooting the ignorance in this life is difficult enough, and now you've got to go uproot it in your previous life? I don't think the Buddha would make a stupid mistake like that. He just was, well, as Gompreet says, one of the world's greatest geniuses. Now, the other reason I don't think the Buddha was talking about the 12 links of dependent origination as a three-lifetime model is that there is no support for a three-lifetime model in the suttas. Just not there. There is support for a two-lifetime model. In Digha Nikaya number 15, the Great Discourse on Origination, there are actually three different discourses. Okay, this is not uncommon. You find a sutta and there are three separate talks in it. It's sort of been jammed together. The first talk is on dependent origination. And it has nine links. Death, birth, becoming, clinging, craving, vedana, contact, no senses, mind and body that are interdependent. And this one is definitely interpreted to be a two-lifetime model, with the mind and body and consciousness being up through craving and clinging, the current birth, and then the becoming, birth, death, your next birth. But this sutta comes from the land of the Kurus. Now, any other sutta you know of that comes from the land of the Kurus? The Satipatthana Sutta comes from the land of the Kurus. And we have a pretty good idea that's a later anthology. And now here we have a sutta that's actually three discourses, and that would tend to indicate that perhaps the sutta might be a later composition. So what did the Buddha really mean there? Well, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was one of the great Thai forest monks of the last century, has an interpretation of dependent origination that's moment to moment. And this interpretation makes a whole lot more sense. Okay, in particular, the moment to moment interpretation is pointing out that you've got a mind and body, and you're conscious, and you've got senses and you get sense contacts, and that's going to produce vedana. Remember, the Buddha said that dukkha arises dependent on craving. All right? So you're up to vedana on automatic. You don't really have any control. I mean, you don't want to get rid of your mind and body. That's not a useful thing to do. And you don't want to get rid of your consciousness. Well, for more than a few hours each night. All right? And you got to keep your senses, and they're going to get sense contacts. And inevitably, that's going to produce vedana. So it's all on automatic up to there. But there is a gap between the vedana and the onset of craving that if you can get your mindfulness in there, second establishment of mindfulness, right, is about vedana, then you can perhaps not get lost in the craving, and then there won't be any clinging or becoming or birth or death or any other dukkha. So there are really two strategies for working with dependent origination. One is, shall we say, moment to moment with the sensory input and catching the vedana and getting in there with your mindfulness before you get lost in the craving and clinging that leads to dukkha. So that's a moment to moment way of working with dependent origination. And then the long-term solution is to uproot the ignorance. Because with no ignorance, then all the rest of the steps don't occur, and the dukkha doesn't occur. Excuse me. Now, Buddhadasa goes into some detail, pointing out how the moment-to-moment dependent origination works, and it's worth thinking about, because it kind of makes little weirdness that birth is right near the end. I mean, most people think of birth as coming first. I mean, didn't you get born sometime like a long time ago? You didn't get born right before you died. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's true for everybody here. I mean, birth is like at the beginning. But here in this thing, it's right towards the end. So, Buddhadasa basically resolves it in a way that's, well, sort of like this. Let's say you never had a mango before. And you go to the grocery store and you're wandering around the produce section. And you see a sign that says mangoes. And you're like, oh, mangoes, I heard of those. They're supposed to be good. And so you go up to this bin and it's got these orange, yellow fruit in it. And you know, you're like, oh, I should try this. And so you buy one and let's say you get a nice ripe one. And you take it home and you put away the rest of the groceries, hopefully. And then you peel the mango and you make a big mess because that's what happens the first time you attack a mango. All right, so you cut off a piece of the mango from the the seed. You got a conscious mind and body. You got senses. Mango hits the tongue. Contact. Vedana. Pleasant Vedana. Oh, this is good. Some more. Craving is setting in. Clinging is setting in. Oh, this is good stuff. I'm going to get a bunch of this. I'm going to go back to the store and get some more. In fact, my friends, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, they've never had mangoes. I'm going to turn them on to mangoes. So you go back to the store, you get some more mangoes, you turn your friends on to mangoes. They're like, oh, cool, thank you for bringing mangoes. This is so wonderful. You have become the mango bringer. You've just given birth to yourself as the mango bringer. And so the next time you go see your friends, you bring them another mango. And they're like, oh, cool, a mango. And you bring another mango the next time, and another mango the time after that. And then they're like, what's with all the mangoes? Uh-oh, death of the mango bringer. So what Buddhadasa is saying is that based on your craving and clinging, you become the craver, the clinger. You give birth to the sense of self. But because the sense of self is a made-up thing, it has this tendency to die if it's not supported, and you have to make it up over and over again. So Buddhadasa is saying, look at your sensory input and notice how, if you're not careful, this triggers craving and clinging, and craving and clinging leads, becomes a self that you've given birth to that is unstable, and having this self is going to lead you to dukkha. This is far more practical than trying to uproot the ignorance in your previous life. And it's a very useful way to look at dependent origination. But I don't think that's what the Buddha meant either. Not to say that you shouldn't work with it this way. In the Sutta Nipata, which is a collection of about 80 suttas, it means the little collection. In book 4, there are suttas, I think I mentioned this, that appear to come from very early in the Buddha's ministry. There are suttas on view, and in particular, not holding to fixed views, not getting entangled in views. And it's clear the Buddha was looking for some peace. And if he argued about views, it wasn't very peaceful. But there are other suttas in there as well as ones about view. The 11th sutta in book 4 of the Sutta Nipata, so Sutta Nipata 4.11, is entitled Quarrels and Disputes. And it appears to be the original sutta on dependent origination. It goes something like this. Someone asked the Buddha, why do quarrels and disputes arise? And the Buddha replies, because people find things dear. It's due to endearment that quarrels and disputes arise. Why do people find things dear? Because they're desirable. And because things are desirable, people find them dear. Why do people find things desirable? It is said in this world, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. It is because of finding things pleasant and unpleasant that people find things desirable. From whence arises the pleasant and the unpleasant? From contact. Contact leads to experiencing things as pleasant or unpleasant. Why does contact arise? Dependent on what does contact arise? Dependent on mind and body, nama rupa. That's why contact arises. Now, does this sound a little bit familiar? Okay, instead of old age, sickness, and death for the dukkha, we get quarrels and disputes. Instead of, well, becoming and birth, we don't get those. Instead of clinging, we get it's dear. It's endearing. That's, yeah, you cling to the endearing stuff. Instead of craving, we get desirable. It's desire. Instead of Vedana, we get it is pleasant, it is unpleasant. exactly the same idea, just using a different words. And the Vedana, or the pleasant is unpleasant, arises dependent on contact. And it's exactly the same Pali word, pasa. Contact arises dependent on mind and body. The six senses are left out. But yeah, you have a mind and body, and it's going to get contact. So this appears to be an early description of dependent origination, going back quarrels and disputes, endearing, desirable, pleasant and unpleasant, contact, mind and body. Now, the line of questioning changes slightly when we get to mind and body. The questioner asks, how can I make body go away? It's not what is mind and body dependent upon, but how can I make body go away? Interesting question. The answer is, one's perception is not the usual one. It's not abnormal. It's not ceased, and it's not false. Truly, papancha, mental proliferation, is what causes the arising of rupa, body. All right, now this is quite different from the usual interpretation or explanation of dependent origination. The word I've translated as perception is sanya, which is the usual translation is perception. But sanya can also at times mean consciousness. In particular, in some of the earliest suttas, sanya means consciousness. An example is Digha Nikaya number 9, the Potapata Sutta. In there, Potapata wants to know about the cessation of higher consciousness, the state of Nirodha, the so-called ninth jhana. And the word he uses, though, is sanya, not vijnana. So if you want to make rupa go away, then you need a consciousness that's not the ordinary kind, not abnormal, not ceased, and not false. You need to look at the world in a different way, is basically what the Buddha is saying. If you can look at the world in a different way, and he doesn't outline here what that different way is, then nama rupa is not happening, because rupa isn't happening, and then you don't get caught up in contact and pleasant, unpleasant, desire, endearment, and quarrels and disputes. As I said, this appears to be the earliest sutta on dependent origination, using different words. So how did we get from those words to the more familiar ones of craving, clinging, becoming, all this other stuff? Well, it turns out in the Upanishads, there's the hymn of creation. All right, so in Brahmanism, the dominant religion at that time, they had a creation hymn. And this explains how the world comes to be. And this creation hymn has 12 verses. And guess what the first verse is about? Ignorance. And the second verse is about sankharas. And the third verse, exactly the words that we find in the 12 links in the suttas. What appears to have happened is that the Buddha discovered dependent origination very early on. In fact, I would say that's probably what led to his awakening. And he used different words to describe it. And when he was by himself, and he didn't have followers, no monasteries, he could explain it using the words that he used to discover it. But as time went by, he wound up with a number of followers who were cognizant of the hymn of creation and who knew the 12 links. And what the Buddha had discovered matched up quite closely with those 12 links, or at least some of them. And so we switched from quarrels and disputes, endearment, desirable, pleasant, unpleasant, contact, nama-rupa, and consciousness as sanya, to old age, sickness, and death. And then some point, birth and becoming got inserted, probably not early on, maybe even after the Buddha's death. And then the more familiar clinging, craving, vedana, contact. The senses didn't get inserted until later on, it appears. And mind and body and consciousness. So it would appear that the Buddha took a concept from a different religion and gave it a new meaning, which he does over and over again. And so his first description of dependent origination, using these unfamiliar to us words, was transformed at some later point into the more familiar words that were stolen from the Upanishad's hymn of creation, but given a completely different meaning. So what the Buddha is describing, it looks like, in this early discourse, is not multiple lifetimes. There is no way possible to interpret Sutta Nipata 4.11 as multiple lifetimes, but is describing dependent conditions. Quarrels and disputes arise dependent on endearment. Finding something dear rises dependent on finding it desirable. Finding something desirable arises dependent upon it producing pleasant or undesirable, unpleasant. And the pleasant and unpleasant arise dependent upon contact and contact on mind and body. And if you don't want the body thing to happen, then mess with your perception, your consciousness, so that it's different from the ordinary kind. What people want to do, though, with dependent origination is make it a linear interpretation of something. And I say it's just a collection of a bunch of necessary conditions. Remember, necessary condition, a necessary condition for the lights to be on is the switch be turned on, right? If you want to turn something off, if you can find a necessary condition and turn off the necessary condition, then you can turn off the thing that you wanted to turn off. It would appear that dependent origination, the 12 links at least, are a collection of necessary conditions, not a linear explanation of anything. Although embedded in the middle of it, there is this linear part. You have a mind and body that's conscious, that gets sense contacts, that has senses that get sense contacts, it produces vedana. And the vedana, if you're not careful, leads to craving and clinging. And that eventually can turn into dukkha. This seeing the dependent origination as a collection of necessary conditions takes it out of the realm of trying to make all this fit together when it actually really doesn't. When I started out, I said, okay, you die because you're born. You're born because of this urge to become. Becoming depends on clinging, and I did that silly thing about making the building. And doesn't that seem like a really weak step there, right? What happens is becoming actually changes context between becoming, birth being dependent on becoming, and becoming arising dependent on clinging. And that change of context just doesn't make any sense if you're trying to make this a linear explanation. So I think what the Buddha is doing here is pointing out a bunch of important necessary conditions that you should pay attention to. If you pay attention to these, then you have a chance to avoid the necessary conditions for dukkha and avoiding the necessary conditions for dukkha, you're free of dukkha. Now, the 12 links of dependent origination, or even the 10 links or the 9 links, is an example of dependent origination. It's not the whole teaching, which is how it's come to be regarded by the time of the Visuddhimagga and pretty much ever since then. Most teachers and students of Buddhism, when they think of dependent origination, think of the 12 links, and the 12 links is definitively dependent origination. As I say, the 12 links is an example, an important example. It's a very useful collection of necessary conditions, but it's not the only way that dependent origination is used. And tomorrow night and the next night, I'll talk about the more general case. The more general case is given as usually this, that conditionality. Dependent upon this, that arises. With the ceasing of this, that does not arise. And this is the general case. And the Buddha uses this basically to elucidate the deepest teachings that are found in the suttas. But dependent origination is also used in another way that is quite interesting. And this is what is usually called transcendental dependent origination. The Upanisa Sutta, which is Samyutta Nikaya 12.23, describes 24 links of dependent origination. It actually shows dependent origination as a model for awakening. It says, knowledge and vision of liberation has a cause or has a necessary condition. It is not without a necessary condition. And what is the necessary condition for knowledge and vision of liberation? Liberation. Liberation has a necessary condition. It is not without a necessary condition. What is the necessary condition for liberation? Dispassion. Dispassion has a necessary condition, is not without a necessary condition. What is the necessary condition for dispassion? We did that already. Anybody remember?
Disenchantment.
Disenchantment has a necessary condition. It's not without a necessary condition. What is the necessary condition for disenchantment? Knowing and seeing things as they really are, or like I want to translate it, knowing and seeing what's actually happening, or insight into the nature of reality. Knowing and seeing what's actually happening has a necessary condition. Necessary condition for knowing and seeing what's actually happening is concentration. Concentration has a necessary condition, is not without a necessary condition. A necessary condition for concentration is sukha. Sukha has a necessary condition, is not without a necessary condition. A necessary condition for sukha is tranquility. Tranquility has a necessary condition, is not without a necessary condition. Necessary condition for tranquility is piti. Piti has a necessary condition, is not without a necessary condition. Necessary condition for piti is? Virya, not in this one. Pamoja, okay? But yeah, in the seven factors, yes, it's virya. But here it's pamoja, or gladness, or the pleasant sensation you focus upon once you've gotten to access concentration. Pamoja has a necessary condition, it is not without a necessary condition. The necessary condition is? Faith, sada, or perhaps more accurately translated, confidence. Confidence has a necessary condition. It is not without a necessary condition. The necessary condition is dukkha. You gain faith that there's a way out of dukkha. Right? You hear the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, and you gain faith that this guy knows what he's talking about. He says, I teach one thing and one thing only, the way out of dukkha. And so you gain confidence and you start practicing. And in practicing, you generate some pamoja, some pleasant sensation, which you can turn into piti. And when you calm down the piti, you get some tranquility. And then sukha. And then concentration. And with a concentrated mind, you gain insight into the nature of reality, become disenchanted, dispassionate, and liberated. Now, dukkha has a necessary condition. It's not without a necessary condition. That is birth. Birth has a necessary condition. It's not without a necessary condition. It is becoming. And so on through all the way back to sankhara has a necessary condition. It's not without a necessary condition. Ignorance. The Buddha says that these necessary conditions show the whole path. The arising of dukkha, and then the ceasing of dukkha. And so dependent origination is now used in a much broader picture to show the whole path to freedom. And this 24 links, this transcendental depiction of dependent origination, is actually further expanded in the commentaries into the progress of insight, building on the higher links of the transcendental part of transcendental dependent origination. They wind up eventually with the progress of insight, throwing in some more stuff that happens along the way. So dependent origination is the heart of the Dharma. Sariputta quotes the Buddha in one of the Majjhima Suttas, number 32, I think. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. This is what it's all about. After his awakening, the Buddha was reluctant to teach because this generation is addicted to its lifestyle. And those who are addicted to their lifestyle, it's very difficult for them to see this truth. That is, this, that conditionality, dependent origination. That was the thing he felt he had to teach. That was the heart of the Dharma. So tonight we've taken a look at the multiple links version of it. But as I say, the next two nights we'll look at more of the general application of dependent origination. So, any questions about what we've talked about so far?
I know you're not going to leave us hanging about that sutta for Dhinapada 411, that
yeah.
What causes the body not to arise. It's some kind of weird thing.
Yeah, so you what sort of perception or consciousness? Okay, I won't tell you tonight, I won't tell you tomorrow night, or the next night, but the night after that, I'll give a whole discourse on it.
Right.
Okay?
Which night of the week is that?
So what's that, Tuesday night? Tonight's Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Yeah, you'll still be here. Yeah.
Can you just restate what he said about consciousness, or what you said?
The translation? Okay, in the Sutta Nipata 411?
Yes.
Okay, so sanya, which we could say is perception or consciousness, that is not ordinary, not abnormal, not ceased, and not false.
Not ordinary, not abnormal.
Not ceased, and not false.
Clear as mud.
Hopefully, Tuesday night, I'll make it even clearer than mud.
What was the reference for the 24 links?
Samyutta Nikaya 12.23, the Upanisa Sutta. And there's a very excellent introduction to that sutta and translation of it on Access to Insight by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So if you plug Upanisa Sutta in the search in Access to Insight.
Nobody must have spelled these things.
But you know 1223. Okay. So you go to the Samyutta Nikaya, you find 1223, you copy Upanishad Sutta, and you plug it into the search. Okay. Yeah.
Because you said that was like weak, and my spontaneous reaction was, how does this fit?
I think that that's something that was trying to squeeze dependent origination into the 12 links, and it just didn't go, right? It just sort of flopped over the edge there. I think that probably it's not from the Buddha, because it really just doesn't go very well. What he's describing is really dukkha is dependent on clinging. So he goes from dukkha to clinging. And the becoming and birth part just wasn't in there. But after his death, people just were like, let's get all the pieces in there. And in particular, they went off into what I refer to as an immortality project. And we can do the becoming and birth in here and make that the next lifetime. And so they squeeze those two in there, and they've got the current life, starting with consciousness and mind and body being dependent on each other, up through the clinging and craving, the craving and clinging. And then they can squeeze these other two in if they make it a new lifetime. And then it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. So I'm basically saying that the Buddha probably didn't teach exactly what has come down to us. That he was teaching more in line what has come down to us in Sutta Nipata 4.11. Dukkha arises because we find stuff dear and desirable.
So if I understood it correctly, he gave a secular understanding to the Upanishads.
Yes, he took the words from the Upanishads and gave them a new interpretation.
Without the... all
yeah,
with all and Brahmas and so on.
Right, exactly. There's a paper on the internet by Joanna Jurowitz, who is an Upanishad scholar, a Brahminical scholar, that talks about the 12 things in the Upanishad Hymn of Creation and how she thinks the Buddha interpreted dependent origination. But she's interpreting dependent origination from the viewpoint of the Upanishad Hymn of Creation, and she gets it wrong.
So, assuming that he knew, because he was from that culture, so he was probably taught, but in early ages, that the Upanishads, how this whole cycle works. So that was his brilliant idea, that like, oh, let me take this and put for a modern view on an older thing.
I don't know whether he made that change or his disciples later made that change. What I can see happening is, okay, he's got his quarrels and disputes, endearing, desirable, and he gets Brahmins as monks, and he's explaining dependent origination to them. Somebody raises their hand and says, that sounds a lot like the Upanishad Hymn of Creation. He goes, yeah, I mean, we can use the same words. So dukkha, clinging, craving, vedana, I mean, it works just as fine. So he switches to the new words, and then somebody else decides to stick in all the other pieces.
So he knew the idea.
He knew the idea.
So is that only original?
Is what?
The dependent origination with a different wording on the dependent origination.
Right.
It's not new. And he knew it wasn't new.
The what we find in 4.11, the quarrels and disputes, endearment, desirable, pleasant, unpleasant. That seems to be original, okay? He got that sitting under the Bodhi tree would be my guess. All right. Now, did he have some hints? We don't know that.
Yeah,
we don't know that. I would think that if he was taking it from the Upanishad of him of creation, he would have used those words originally. The fact that he used different words makes me think that he came up with it independently and later switched to using those words. Either he did or his followers did. But the fact that he's using the different words, I mean, why would he take an idea and tweak the idea and throw out the idea and the words and then later bring back the words? That doesn't make sense. We would have kept the words from the beginning. So the fact that we find...
To look at new.
Well, I think he came up with the idea. There certainly were teachings about one thing being dependent on another.
Right.
All right? But the sequence of quarrels and disputes, endearing, desirable, pleasant, unpleasant contact, nama-rupa, I think he came up with on his own, but he might have been influenced by the fact that he knew the Upanishad. But there's no way to tell. There's just simply no way to tell. It's all conjecture.
So when you were talking about the Asa's take on all this, especially his interpretation of becoming, and I think just prior to that, you talked about that opportunity between craving
Vedana and craving. Right. I think it's a very useful interpretation, although I don't think it's the Buddha's interpretation. In other words, it's a linear interpretation, and I think it's quite helpful. I just don't think that's what the Buddha thought about it. Yeah. There's a very good book by Buddhadasa entitled Paticca-samuppada, and it's now on the internet, and it's linked from my reading list. And so each of the chapters is a web page, and so you can save the pages and read it. That's the easiest way to get that book with that detailed interpretation. Otherwise, you have to order it from Thailand, and it's a hassle, but doable. And Santikaro has translated a huge number of other talks on dependent origination by Ajahn Buddhadasa, and has a book that will be coming out from Wisdom. I think it'll be early next year. I think that was the latest I had heard. It's been in process for quite a number of years. But with Santikaro's illness, it got put on the shelf for a while. But I think it's now reached, you know, that sort of like, okay, it's in the hand of the publisher. So that will be a very interesting book to take a look at, dependent origination through the eyes of Buddhadasa. And I think there'll be a lot of very helpful stuff in there. But I haven't read the book. I'm just guessing. Well, one way to practice that is found in the suttas is to recognize that, okay, if I don't pay attention to the Vedana, I easily get swept up into craving and clinging. So practice being there, second foundation, with the Vedana so you don't get swept up. The other is that when you do get swept up into owning things or wanting things, you can notice that you're generating a sense of self around these objects. I am the one who owns this little timer that has early stage Alzheimer's, right? I am the one who drinks out of this glass. So I'm now creating myself based out of the craving and clinging. So it's really hard to watch it happen. It goes really fast. But particularly it's useful when you have a sense of self to look at what is your sense of self defined around. And it's very often you have become the idea that you currently have about yourself due to the cravings and clingings. And I think that's a very interesting way to look at it.
In your view, what is the novel idea in a big question?
Yeah.
And the doctrine, and the canon, that's
I think the novel idea is that dukkha has a necessary condition. Actually, it has several necessary conditions. And if you can manipulate those necessary conditions to turn them off, you can turn off the dukkha.
I'm trying to understand what is it new about the dependent origination idea.
I don't think the idea of necessary condition was that well known at the time of the Buddha, because the hymn of creation is not about necessary conditions, it's about causes, right? And causes are different from necessary conditions. The light switch doesn't cause the lights to shine. The cause is electrons exciting the filament, okay?
He went beyond.
Yeah, he found something that was practical.
Right.
It wasn't just this, oh, here's what's going on, you should worship it. It was like, yeah, you want to get out of dukkha, manipulate the necessary condition. So I think that was part of it. And I think also identifying what the problem was. The problem is dukkha, right? Everybody's trying to discover how the world became and how it's going to unfold and all this stuff. And he's going, nah, you don't need to know that. You need to recognize your dukkha and find the necessary condition so you can turn it off. So defining the problem, first noble truth. Discovering a necessary condition that was manipulable, second noble truth. And manipulating it, third noble truth. And learning how to manipulate it, fourth noble truth. That was the novel idea.
Is it possible that he rediscovered it because the Brahmin culture of the time and the religion permeates the whole society was something built on originally what he saw, and they built this kind of religion just to, like all religions are, built on something.
Yeah. I don't think we find hints of dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths in the early Upanishad or the Rig Veda or anything like that. But the Buddha did say, I mentioned Samyutta 1265, it's entitled The City, and that's the one with the 10 links. And so he says the night of his enlightenment, he works his way back through the 10 links and then finds that mind and body and consciousness are mutually dependent. And he says, this is like someone wandering in the jungle and coming across an abandoned road and following that abandoned road until he comes to an abandoned city. And he sees this abandoned city used to be a magnificent place. And that person goes back and tells the king or a king's minister, rehabilitate this city, make it wonderful again. And that king or king's minister rehabilitates the city, and it's beautiful, wonderful again. It's the same with the path of dependent origination that he has discovered. All the ancients who ever found their way to full awakening discovered this same path. So he's not inventing something new. He's discovering something that had been forgotten. But I don't think it was the Upanishads that forgot it. Okay, he's saying, no, it's even before them that it was forgotten.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It was before it.
Yeah, it was before
that had been covered by all the layers of religion, the Brahmin.
Right, and whether it actually was ever known before or not, who knows? Okay, but what he's basically saying is he's not inventing something; he's discovering something that's been there all along that people couldn't see because of the jungle thicket of confusion, right? The addiction to the lifestyle that was there.
So there is some commonality though between the idea of enlightenment and what you have in the Taoists. Not the method, but the state of mind and the attitude.
Right. Taoism, which originated in China probably around the same time as the Buddha, but a bit earlier, and originated independently, seems to be pointing to some very similar ideas. That's why when Buddhism went to China, it could merge with Taoism and produce what we know now as Zen Buddhism, Chan Buddhism in China. So yeah, there was a very, very highly compatible system there. And some of the aspects of Taoism you would think are Buddhist. And in fact, the founder of Taoism is said to be Lao Tzu, the old man. And he decided to retire from the world. And when he reached the frontier to go out the gate into the wilds, the guard at the frontier wouldn't let him leave until he wrote down what we now have as the Tao Te Ching. And then he left and he went to India and he was the Buddha. Okay, so that's one of the understandings of Buddhism in one of the schools in China. So because of the similarities there, they're actually making Lao Tzu and the Buddha the same person.
A similar question. Since it's already there, enlightenment's possible. Can you imagine someone being enlightened free, but not necessarily having the mind or the even the desire to articulate it with the succinctness that the Buddha?
There's a name for a person like that. It's called a Pacheka Buddha. A Pacheka Buddha is someone who becomes enlightened, awakens, on their own, without other people teaching them, but they don't teach. Probably because it's too hard to teach this stuff, right? So the idea of Pacheka Buddha appears in the suttas, I think. Certainly appears in the Abhidhamma and the commentaries.
My question, though, is they may not even in their... within themselves have the articulate skills to have the discussion.
Right.
They're just free.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what a Pacheka Buddha is. Right. If someone has the capacity to discuss it out of compassion, they would talk about it with others. But it just happened to them and they don't know how to articulate it. So yeah, there's a whole history and mythology around Pacheka Buddhas and so forth. And Aya came up in referring to who am I? Ramana Maharshi said that he was a self-enlightened being in India in the first half of the 20th century. So she felt that Ramana Maharshi was fully awakened and really couldn't articulate what he discovered in the same way that the Buddha did, because what he was teaching was to go around asking, who am I? I am that. And that was his teaching. Who am I? Who am I? Okay. So not quite as much detail there as what the Buddha had. So I think she would consider him a Pacheka Buddha.
Is your book going to have this treatment of the dependent origination?
No, that's the next book. Yeah, the first book is on the jhanas. The next book will be on dependent origination. So, and it'll just be transcripts of the talk you heard tonight and the next couple of nights, so you'll get it.
What does the Abhidhamma say about dependent origination?
I haven't looked at dependent origination in the Abhidhamma, so I'm not sure. I suspect it's going up for multiple lifetimes, because you find the multiple lifetimes, as I said, in like Digha Nikaya number 15. And that's a late sutta. So if it's something that's early enough to appear in the suttas, then it probably shows up in the Abhidhamma as well. So I'm guessing, but not certain, that the Abhidhamma talks about multiple lifetimes. The Visuddhimagga certainly talks about it. And that's all the Visuddhimagga talks about it, about dependent origination.
So, if somebody's having a midlife crisis and they buy a Porsche to make them look sexy or have sex appeal, that's craving for becoming.
Right. Yeah. It's also craving for not becoming old. Right. So, yeah. It's
craving for that image.
Right. It's craving for the image of young and sexy. Yeah. Right.
What is the Visuddhimagga?
The Visuddhimagga All right. So in India, in the 5th century AD, the two major monasteries in Sri Lanka were fighting, as they had been for centuries, fighting for support of the king. And so one would be in ascendancy and the other would be struggling. And then a new king would come in and they would fight, and the other one would come up and the first one would be down. So at this time, Abhayagiri was in ascendancy and the great monastery was the one that was down. And the people at the great monastery got this idea. Let's take all of the commentaries that we have in Sinhalese and translate them into Pali, because that'll be really cool and the king will be impressed. So they hired an editor by the name of Buddhaghosa, who was from South India and had been raised as a Brahmin. And he came over and he headed up this translation project of taking all of the existent commentaries, the existent commentaries to each of the suttas. So I told you the Samanyapala Sutta. Well, there was a Sinhalese language commentary to that sutta. And so Buddhaghosa took all those commentaries and translated them into Pali. But he was smart in that stuff that appeared in a lot of places, he put those into a separate encyclopedic work called the Visuddhimagga, which talks about morality, concentration, and wisdom. And it brings up a number of things, such as the jhanas, and such as dependent origination, and so forth. And so when he gets to a place in a sutta where it talks about the jhanas, instead of putting into that commentary the translation of all the stuff about the jhanas, he puts in Sivasuddhimagga. Right? So it's the commonly occurring themes that are found in the suttas. So it's a very good summary of the understanding of the suttas in the 5th century AD. Unfortunately, although it's well organized and there's a good translation of it and it has lots of information in it, it's wrong. Well, at least in a lot of places, in my opinion, it just simply doesn't understand what the Buddha was talking about. It's very far removed from the culture. And the idea of what the jhanas were has evolved to where they're very, very different from what's in the suttas. The dependent origination has become this multiple lifetime immortality project. And so it's completely missing the whole heart of what the Buddha was talking about with dependent origination. So although it's got a lot of stuff in it, and it's a very good translation, not so useful. The one thing I will say, though, if you have a copy of it and you have insomnia, all you have to do is open it at random and start reading. It'll put you right out.
There are people following that, right?
Oh, yes. There are a lot of people. In fact, Theravadan Buddhism is basically Visuddhimagga Buddhism. It's based on that rather than even the Abhidhamma or the suttas.
And they get enlightened with all that wrong information.
I suppose. Or at least they get to what they call enlightenment. Okay? I mean, the one person I know for certain got enlightened was the Buddha. And ever since I started studying Buddhism, I wanted to know what the Buddha was up to. I wanted to know what practices he was doing. All right? That was seemed to me to be the stuff that I could trust more than anything else. So that's why I'm interested in that. And this other stuff that I can definitely tell is different. Maybe it works, but you know, I'm going to put my money on the Buddha.
The commentaries in the case of the jhanas, for instance, that became from something that would be accessible for someone that put some effort in to become just to have the realm of some one in 1 million. Do you think it was already the making of a religion like the Brahmin was, like, I know how to do it, but you needs to guide you.
Right. There is some hints in what we find about Buddhism, say, in the 5th century, that it had become a very elite thing.
Right.
And those who were very elite were looking for power, right? And so they had this elite thing, and if you want to do it, you've got to come to me.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, the translating of all the commentaries into Pali worked, and the great monastery went up, and Abhayagiri went down, and Abhayagiri never came back. Yeah, so yeah, there is that control that comes by having a practice almost nobody can do, and you want to learn it, you've got to come to me.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas the Buddha's like, yeah, go do your jhanas.
Right, right.
I mean, he would often give a discourse and say, monks, they're roots of trees, they're empty huts, go practice jhana. It was just everybody was expected to do it.
Why would they translate it into Pali? Was it still a going concern in 580?
Well, they had the suttas and the Abhidhamma and the Vinaya in Pali, so it was still a going concern. So it just was like, all right, this will impress the king. So that's why they did it. But yeah, they knew Pali quite well. So they hired a Pali scholar to come over and help and be the editor-in-chief. I would say Buddhaghosa didn't write the Visuddhimagga. He was the editor-in-chief, and he pulled the material out of the existing commentaries, which we no longer have.
Does the practice of saying phrases for doing metta, does that come from the Visuddhimagga?
The categories come from the Visuddhimagga. Okay, so the yourself, the benefactor, the friend, the acquaintance, the enemy, and then all the various categories going out comes from the Visuddhimagga. I think the phrases are later. I think they come from something later than the Visuddhimagga, but I can't really remember. I think that's the case. Okay, it's definitely time for a very short break and then metta.